Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 21st of April. It's All Things Political, Monday at 9 o'clock, and today we will center on tomorrow's presidential primary in Pennsylvania, which has perhaps been too long a time in coming. It's an important primary in a very big state. Recent polls are showing Clinton's former double-digit lead has dwindled to the single digits, but we'll see what happens tomorrow. Most political analysts believe that she will win the state, but the question is by how much. And there will be a big debate about the size of her victory if she wins. Of course, you've heard that a victory would allow her to say that she should be the party's nominee because she's able to win swing states like Ohio and big blue states like Pennsylvania. A win may help her in Indiana and North Carolina, holding primaries May 6, West Virginia on May 13, and Kentucky and Oregon on May 20th. But if she doesn't win big, say 5 to 7 percentage points, Obama could claim a victory. In some ways, it'll be good for this primary to be over because a lot of the campaigning has been less than inspirational. Our guest this hour is Professor Michael Hagan. He is a professor of political science at Temple University in Philadelphia, where he's director of Temple's Institute for Public Affairs. He's co-author of the forthcoming The Presidential Campaign of 2000 and the Foundations of Party Politics, co-author of Race and Inequality, A Study in American Values, and a contributor to Reasoning and Choice, Explorations in Political Psychology. Professor Hagan has also taught at the Department of Government, at Harvard, and at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He was most recently director of the Center for Public Interest Polling at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, is a member of the editorial board of the Harvard International Journal of Press and Politics, and has served as program chair of the Political Communication Division of the American Political Science Association. Well, welcome phone calls for Michael. Here's our phone number, as always, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Oh, it's been a long time waiting for this primary, Michael.
If you think it seems long from Wisconsin, imagine what it feels like in Philadelphia.
No, how does it feel in Philadelphia?
Well, it feels like it's been nonstop campaign advertising on television for 6 weeks. That's one thing it feels like. And it feels like the news media have been swarming around the state for the past 6 weeks. I think a lot of Pennsylvanians are still quite excited about this, but they'll be glad to get back to life as it normally is in a couple of days.
Tell me about some of those ads. We've been hearing about the fact that they're negative, but we don't see them in Wisconsin. What are they like?
Well, they haven't, to my mind, they haven't been particularly nasty, that's for certain. They have drawn distinctions between the candidates, but my view is they haven't been personal in their attacks. They haven't been overly negative. They've simply drawn contrast between the candidates.
Mm-hmm. So what's the wisdom here? Does she have to win double digits tomorrow, or if she wins by just a couple points, is that still okay? What's the plan?
Well, it really depends on what how you want to define victory here. What this contest is all about is delegates to the Democratic National Convention, and the delegates whose opinions are going to matter most are going to be the superdelegates, those who aren't pledged on the basis of the outcome of the primaries and caucuses. And what exactly is going to sway those people in one direction or another is really difficult to figure. So certainly there are many who argue that what the superdelegates who have yet to commit themselves are looking for is evidence that one candidate or the other is substantially more electable than the other. And it's the extent to which whoever wins tomorrow can claim that he or she is more electable nationwide, or at least in the battleground states in the fall. That's the way the outcome has to be interpreted.
And what do you think, Michael? Is one substantially more electable than another?
I don't think there's a lot of evidence that one is more electable than the other at this point, and so it's difficult to imagine just what's going to sway the superdelegates. if Senator Obama were to win Pennsylvania, that certainly would be a big blow
right.
to Senator Clinton's argument that she can win the big states, she can win the close states, and so on. What it will take to take the wind out of Senator Obama's sails is a little bit more difficult to imagine. I would certainly say that if Senator Clinton wins by more than 10 percentage points, that the press will be regarding it as a major victory for her, and that will be communicated to the superdelegates. Anywhere between 0 and 10 percentage points, though, I would expect both candidates to be claiming a victory of sorts, and I rather doubt that that the outcome will be decisive.
Yeah. We've been so reluctant to believe the polls, as you well know, ever since New Hampshire, that these polls have been all over the place. She's had, as far as I can remember, 15% lead, and now it's 5 to 6% lead. Who are you to believe?
Well, you're making two different observations. One is that the polls have been all over the place, and I think that's true, that the polls have varied in for a lot of different reasons. I think, frankly, there have been so many polls now, it's been a little bit difficult to judge the quality of the polls, and there are lots of websites now that sort of lump them all together into one big pile, and we're supposed to treat them all as equal, and I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. But in any case, there's a lot of divergence among them. The other is that things really have changed over the past couple of months here in Pennsylvania. Senator Clinton did have a double-digit lead, as you say, and that has dwindled down now, certainly to single digits, probably on the order of 6 to 8 percentage points, maybe 5. But the fact is that most of that happened up until about the 1st of April. And over the past 3 weeks, there really hasn't been a whole heck of a lot of change in the polls here in Pennsylvania. Things have been remarkably stable despite all the activity and all the press coverage and all the campaigning.
So what happened to her campaign? Why down?
Well, it's been the pattern in all the primary and caucus states, or the vast majority of them, certainly those in which there's been a real active campaign. Senator Obama has picked up a lot of voters when he's come into a state, both by virtue of being able to advertise on television and by virtue of visiting the state himself. So the pattern in Pennsylvania, actually, the extent to which it diverges from earlier states is the extent to which Senator Clinton's been able to hold on to her lead, and the polls really flatten out over the past several weeks.
I thought that we had been reduced perhaps to the ridiculous, maybe not, maybe this is significant, when I was reading yesterday that Clinton leads big, 54% to 33% among bowlers and 53% to 28% among gun owners.
Well, gun owners are a substantial fraction of the electorate. Now, I didn't see that poll, so I don't know what fraction of Pennsylvanians claim to be bowlers. I don't know whether that's a significant
24%.
Holy smoke.
I know.
Well, it certainly is significant, Ben.
Yeah, I guess so.
None of their ads have actually featured bowling, as far as I know.
Maybe that'll be next. We still got a day to go here.
That's right.
Yeah, we can bring it down even more. You have said that Obama is expected to do well in the largely African-American and affluent southeastern quarter of the state, including Philadelphia and the surrounding suburbs, where a lot of Pennsylvanians live, and she will do well where?
She will do well in the west and in the central part of the state, the rural part of the state, and the portions where there are a lot of blue-collar white voters. That's where her strengths are.
And that 40% of where Pennsylvanians live is a fairly substantial portion of the population,
the
right?
40% in southeastern Pennsylvania, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's certainly the most heavily populated part of the state. The Allegheny County and Pittsburgh are also heavily populated, but the southeastern part of the state is where most of the people in Pennsylvania live.
Some of the commentators over the weekend were saying that the undecided voters, and I'm not sure how many there are in Pennsylvania, will break for Clinton.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. First of all, I'm not sure there are a lot of undecided voters left. One way of interpreting the way the polls have stayed pretty steady over the past several weeks is that most people have made up their minds. There aren't many people left to be persuaded one way or another. Actually, in our survey, we found that the undecided voters in the survey we did here at Temple, we found that undecided voters lean toward Obama. So I don't think so. As you say, the polls disagree on some of these things, and I don't think it's exactly clear which way they're going to go.
Mm-hmm. If Obama should win Pennsylvania tomorrow, and I don't think there's a strong likelihood of that happening, is this race over? Would she be compelled to withdraw?
Well, I don't know that she'd be compelled to withdraw. The superdelegates whose opinions really are going to matter here may well be persuaded, if Senator Obama were to win Pennsylvania, that he is the more electable of the two. But until a lot of superdelegates start to declare their intention to support Senator Obama at the convention, I don't really imagine that there's going to be an awful lot of pressure on Senator Clinton to withdraw.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Michael, that the wind has been taken out of his sails in any way, that he's lost some of the inspiration because of the nature of this campaign, that he's been on the defensive?
That's very hard to say. It certainly feels that way. But I think some of it here in Pennsylvania is also just the amount of time and the amount of energy that's been invested in this campaign, so that the wind's kind of gone out of everybody's sails mm-hmm. here to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect, when they move to North Carolina, there's going to be a great deal of enthusiasm for his campaign there. He's certainly well ahead in the polls there. I think whatever momentum he may have lost here may well be expanded there. He's had a rough couple of weeks, that's for sure. He's got a rough ride from the press over the past couple of weeks. And that may, in the end, make a difference, although, as I say, it hasn't moved polls here in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of that ABC debate? Did you think it was abysmal?
Well, yes, I certainly shared the widespread opinion that the the moderators could have done a better job of posing questions, finding questions that would have illuminated more things for the candidates. There's been a lot of talk about the flag lapel pin question. My favorite or least favorite of the questions was the one on which they tried to pin down each candidate on whether the other could win, which seemed to me to be information that's of absolutely zero value to voters.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was an awful lot of attention. There was an opportunity wasted there. I think a lot more could have been learned by a lot more people about where the candidates stood on the important questions.
And there are so many issues, particularly economic issues now. People are really hurting.
That's true. Pennsylvania is actually doing a little bit better than the country as a whole in a lot of economic terms, but there's certainly a lot of folks who are concerned about housing, concerned about health care, concerned about unemployment, concerned about gas prices. There's a lot more they could have talked about.
Right. Let's take phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Just one more question for Michael from me, and then we'll go to you. You were quoted as saying, and a lot of people would disagree with you on this, Michael, the belief that a lengthy contest between the candidates for the Democratic nomination would benefit the Republican nominee is not being borne out in Pennsylvania.
Well, again, I'm basing that claim on the fact that the candidates are doing well in the polls relative to Mr. McCain. So in the survey that we did here at Temple a couple of weeks back, we found that both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama would win handily in a head-to-head matchup with Senator McCain right now. And that suggests to me that, at least so far, the Democratic campaign has not cost them much in the way of support in the Pennsylvania electorate. Now, it's also true that there has been no Republican campaign here, and that might make quite a difference. I certainly would expect that the fall campaign will be a competitive one.
Professor Michael Hagan is our guest on All Things Political. We're talking about the presidential primary in Pennsylvania, which is finally taking place tomorrow. He's a professor of political science at Temple and director of Temple's Institute for Public Affairs, co-author of Presidential Campaign of 2000 and the Foundation of Party Politics, also co-author of Race and Inequality, a Study in American Values, and a contributor to Reasoning and Choice and a number of other books. And we're welcoming calls for him. And we have one line open, so take it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Email, if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Professor Michael Fagan, and we start our calls with Pat from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how are you doing?
All right, Pat, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
Just have a question for Michael. Since we were talking a little bit about the debate last week, I want to specifically ask about the question from, I think it was Charlie Gibson to Barack Obama regarding the capital gains tax. Obviously, one of Barack Obama's goals is to lower the economic tax burden on the middle class, or at least that's what he says. I thought it was a great question because on one hand, he's saying he wants to do that. On the other hand, he's saying he wants to raise the capital gains tax from 15 to 28%, which 50% of the folks that would affect make under $52,000 a year. So I guess how does that dichotomy kind of play into his overall goal?
Well, Pat, it sounds like you may know more about the tax code than I do. I'm not sure that I can help you out here. Certainly, it was a moment in the debate when it seemed that Senator Obama was on the defensive and where he seemed to be contradicting himself in some degree. He's put in the position, and I think one of the things that people worry about with respect to the length of the campaign is that both candidates have sort of allowed themselves to be painted into corners on some issues, and this may be one of them on which Senator Obama feels that he's been painted into a corner. He's committed himself to not raising income taxes on middle income people, but he's still got to find ways to raise revenue in order to pay for the programs that he wants to expand, and that's obviously his motive for raising the capital gains tax.
Frank Rich, who I always read on Sunday, had an interesting paragraph on this. He said the most revealing moment in the debate was a striking example of this media populist disconnect. In Mr. Gibson's only passionate query of the night, he tried to strong-arm both Democrats into foregoing any increases in the capital gains tax. The capital gains tax! Exclamation point. That's just the priority Americans are focusing on as they lose their houses and jobs and as gas prices reach $4 a gallon, a subject that merited only a brief mention in a lightning round of final questions.
I did feel that there was probably more time spent on the capital gains tax than there might have been, and that Mr. Gibson pursued Senator Obama in particular on it with enthusiasm, let's say.
Yeah. I really agree with Rich that I don't think it's high on the priority list of most Americans. I think making enough money to feed your family and pay for the gas in your car might be a little more important.
To the average American, I'm certain you're correct.
Yeah. Thanks, Pat, for the call. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to look at the fall campaign a little bit and just cite the four horsemen of the apocalypse for the Republicans in terms of winning elections. In appealing to the upper middle class and the rich, the two horsemen are hypocrisy and greed, and for the poor and the lower middle class, it's fear and resentment. And I'd like to focus on resentment because I think that that people need to think about what they're most resentful for. I resent the losses of the war, the fact that the debt from the war is going to cut into entitlements and the price of gas. I think also that we view torture as just some recent phenomenon, but if you go back in history, really from Guatemala in the 50s on, we've been engaged in torture. The lady who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize was citing a situation where she saw indigenous Indians beaten and set fire, soaked in gasoline and set fire. And in Chile, a lady was forced to watch somebody tortured to death over 5 hours, as well as seeing three cellmates who were nude and drugged, forced to perform an erotic dance, and then they were raped. And In Brazil, they during the 60s, they had a priest who was, they put a wire up to his tongue and said, "Receive the Eucharist." And he was shocked so much that he couldn't even speak for a considerable period of time and later committed suicide. So these things, the renditions and the tortures that the Bush administration has approved, are really part of a long pattern. And you know, do we resent the Republicans or the centrist Democrats who are complicit with us, or perhaps we should resent the most of all the American people who have ignored this and not read up on this and not worked against it, at least taken as a whole they haven't. And so what do we really resent? Maybe that's something we ought to think about for this campaign.
Well, certainly the war and continued revelations about torture and the motivation behind the war, the logic that led us into Iraq in the first place, all those are questions that are going to be raised in the fall campaign. They're going to be raised between the nomination campaign and the fall campaign, if there is any space between those two, by the continued work of journalists. There have been more stories just in the past couple of weeks on this subject, and I think the way in which the issue of the war plays out between Senator McCain and the Democratic nominee is going to be one of the critical keys to the fall campaign.
Mm-hmm. And what did you mean by that? Do you think that this thing is going to go all the way to the convention?
I can't imagine that it will go to the convention, but I can't imagine that it will go to the week before the convention. I don't think. I wouldn't say that's extremely likely, but it's not impossible.
Right. Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Jack from Eagle River. Hello, Jack.
Yes, good morning. Long time.
Yeah, how are you?
Just fine. I hope you're the same.
Yes, I am.
That's more important than how I am. two things I wanted to bring up. First thing is McCain's age. Now, when Reagan was in office at that time, I think he was the oldest guy to assume office, and there was some evidence of early onset of Alzheimer's at the time he was still in office. So without saying anything about that specifically in connection with McCain, it just seems as though McCain's age, when the two of them are in a debate, and here's Obama, let's just say it's Obama, 43-year-old, vibrant younger man, and here's the 71-year-old guy standing next to him, it just seems to me as though that's going to be a real advantage for Obama. That's my first point. If you'd like, I'll hold a second for
sure. Okay. Michael?
I think that's a good observation, Jack. I think that a lot of people are thinking along the same lines. Senator Obama actually is 48, I believe, but I hasten to add that I regard that as young, too. And by comparison with Mr. McCain standing next to one another on the stage, I suspect you're right that Mr. Obama is going to appear considerably younger, more active, perhaps. And I think that will be something that plays with voters.
My second point, if you will, is the elitism charge against Obama. Now, I think that is the most ludicrous thing. And in the wake of 8 years of favoritism toward, and in fact, Bush even came out and said, this is my base, you know, the those who have and those who have more, and all of that kind of thing. He just rubbed our nose in it. And now they're trying to get away with charging Obama with being elitist. I think that's sad.
Well, I think there's no doubt that if Senator Obama is the Democratic nominee, he's going to be facing that charge again in the fall. He would have been facing it even if he hadn't made the comments he made in San Francisco, and I think now that there's at least a somewhat audible audio tape that has him suggesting what he suggested in San Francisco, it's bound to come back, and it's a charge that will carry weight with some people, I'm sure.
And tell me the basis of it, because of the comments that he made about guns and religion in Pennsylvania, or why does that charge stick with him exactly?
Well, I think it sticks because he made the comments, because he said that he questioned the basis for people's attachment to religion and to a cultural icon like hunting. The reason it sticks, I think, in part is because his campaign is in part intended to convey the impression that he's above the fray, and that, from some angles, invites the accusation that he's actually out of touch. And I think that, plus the fact that he has the advice of academics. He speaks a language that's not typical political language. Now, that's part of his appeal, but it also may be a weak spot, one that the Republicans, I'm sure, will probe.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's another way to read all of that, too, which some have said, and I guess the majority of American people didn't read it that way, was that in times that are difficult economically, we sometimes hold on to those things that give us comfort or a part of our tradition. And admit, for many people, it's guns, and for some people, it's religion. So there's a way to look at that where it's not necessarily elitist.
Absolutely, and that of course is what he's been saying he intended to say all along.
Mm-hmm. But
the way he put it opens up the
right
church that I've laid out.
Right, and then what about her response, though? Senator Clinton's response, you know, that she learned to shoot guns, and you know, she talks about guns here. It's kind of an odd debate for the Democrats to be having when, you know, in some ways, guns are problematic, particularly in large American cities. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, it does and it doesn't here in Pennsylvania. You've told me 24% are bowlers. I don't know what percentage are gun owners, but it's a substantial percentage, and even among Democrats, it's a substantial percentage.
38% are gun owners.
Well, that's even bigger than I would have imagined.
Yeah.
So there's a difficult line to try to. Tightrope to try to walk here in Pennsylvania between gun owners in the rural parts of the state and the urban parts of Pennsylvania, where gun violence is certainly much more a concern than
yes.
The right to hunt.
Mm-hmm. Right. Jack, thanks so much for your call. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Professor Michael Hagan, professor of political science at Temple University and director of their Institute for Public Affairs, is our guest this hour as we look at the Pennsylvania primary, which is finally taking place tomorrow. Ben from Merrill. Hi, Ben.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I'm kind of curious, are the Republicans going to be able to cross over vote in Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania is a closed primary state, which means you have to be registered as a Democrat in order to vote in the Democratic primary. I think some Republicans will be surprised to find that on primary day. I actually was aware on Super Tuesday that in New Jersey, across the river here, a lot of Republicans went to the polls and intended to vote in the Democratic primary there and were surprised to find that they were prohibited from doing so. Some of that will go on here in Pennsylvania as well. The bigger story here is that in the weeks leading up to the deadline for registering for the primary, which was a month before the primary itself, a substantial number of people changed their registration to the Democratic Party, something like 100,000 statewide. And one of the wild cards here is just how are those folks going to vote? What is it that drew them to the Democratic primary, and for which candidate they're going to vote? One version is that they're enthusiastic about one candidate or the other. Another is Rush Limbaugh's version, which is that Republicans are following his instructions to go over to the Democratic side and play havoc in the Democratic primary in order to lengthen it and increase the Republicans' chances in the fall. So how that's going to come out is one of the interesting questions for Tuesday.
Do you have any idea which way they would be voting?
Well, I think it's unlikely, to be honest, that many of them are coming over, that many Republicans have re-registered as Democrats in order to make mischief in the Democratic primary. Mm-hmm. I think what little evidence we've been able to gauge suggests that perhaps Senator Obama has drawn more people into the Democratic Party than Senator Clinton has. There have also been a substantial number of new registrations, again, approaching 100,000. And those people tend to be young and tend to be Obama supporters. So from that point of view, the new registrations seem to favor Senator Obama.
Mm-hmm. Michael, do you have any idea what's going to happen tomorrow? I mean, when you think about it today, do you think it could be a runaway for her, or it could be very close, so there's a chance he could win? Do you know?
Well, I wouldn't rule out any of those scenarios.
Right, <yeah. laughs>
But I think the most probable, I mean, I'm in the polling business to some degree,
right.
and I despite the difficulties this year, have some confidence that across a bunch of polls, we get a pretty good picture of where the electorate stands. So I suspect that Senator Clinton probably will win the statewide vote by between 5 and 8 percentage points, something like that. But beyond that, though, is the question of how delegates will be allocated between the candidates. And because of the way the Democratic rules work, allocating delegates proportionally, that whatever the spread between the candidates in the popular vote, the spread in delegates is likely to be smaller. So the real answer is that I don't think tomorrow is going to be decisive one way or another.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything decisive that could happen that would allow her to secure the nomination?
Well, she would have to win some primaries where she's not expected to win, and she would have to persuade some super, she would have to create a stampede among the superdelegates, I guess, get a bunch of them to endorse her publicly, and create some momentum among superdelegates, some belief among superdelegates that she's inevitably going to be the nominee and therefore deserving of their support.
Right.
It's a tough hand to play. She's not in a good position, that's for sure.
Thanks very much for your call, Ben. And we go to Tim from Toma. Hi, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring out the thing on age. I think it's when people say that, oh, McCain's too old, I think it's very reflective of the Democratic Party, especially the MoveOn.org type part. I think it's discriminatory. I mean, and just over the weekend, we saw the Pope come to America. Here's a guy, he's like 82 years old, and he's able to touch, I think he touched millions of people over the weekend. And I think all the, you know, you look at like all the baby boomers, all the older generation individuals that are out there, I think it's offensive to say that, oh, just because you're old, you automatically have Alzheimer's. And I think he brings a strong character, a lot of experience, a lot more experience than Barack Obama, who is a rookie senator with virtually no experience, no foreign policy experience. And I just when I hear this, it just seems like the Democratic Party, it's either you agree with us. Another caller called in and used the term moderate Democrat as that was like a bad thing. You know, where I think the Democratic Party is in crisis right now. It's losing its identity. It's being hijacked by groups like MoveOn.org and just the total diehards.
Michael.
Putting the Democratic Party together is going to be a challenge, no matter who wins. But it does seem to me that Democrats are pretty much uniformly enthusiastic about winning back the White House, and that's obviously going to be the lever that the candidates try to use in order to put the party back together. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, as some might have thought it was a year ago, that the Democrats are going to win the White House in 2008. Senator McCain is, in some respects, a formidable candidate, just as Tim points out. And I think it's going to be a dogfight.
I think the big issue, though, is going to be the war. You can have different perspectives on that war. And as we looked at what happened with the midterms a couple of years ago, those were won by the Democrats on the basis of the war. Unless things improve dramatically, don't you think the Democrats have a huge advantage?
I do. It's pretty difficult to predict this far out just what role the war is going to play. I mean, we certainly anticipated a year ago that the war would be front and center in the Democratic nominating campaign.
Right.
And partly because the candidates don't differ a whole lot on the question, it's sort of faded from view. I mean, they do differ in the sense that they cast different votes on the authorization to go to war in the first place, and Senator Obama's early successes were very heavily dependent upon that. But the issue has, to some degree, faded from view to everyone's shock. But, you know, given the state of the economy and given that the war has settled down, or did settle down, I'm not sure what the right way is to put it, there did seem to be, you know, it's not surprising given those facts that the economy has moved to the forefront.
More phone calls in a moment. Professor Michael Hagan is our guest this hour. It's All Things Political, and we're centering on the race we've been centering on for 6 weeks now. The primary in Pennsylvania tomorrow, a big primary. And he is a professor of political science at Temple University in Philadelphia, director of Temple's Institute for Public Affairs, author of a number of books, most recently director of the Center for Public Interest Polling at the Eagle Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, and has been involved in polling himself in many ways. So we're talking about what's going on, how the race is being played out in Pennsylvania, the importance of the race, the margin of victory that will be meaningful for Senator Clinton, how those delegates will be divvied up, and we'll spend some time, too, talking about the impact of Pennsylvania on the primaries that come after Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Indiana, and whether or not a lead for her will be important in how those other states go, Kentucky and Oregon, West Virginia as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Extraordinary librarian Nancy Pearl is with us the second hour of the program. If you have books you'd like to suggest to other listeners, or if you have a book that you would like to read and you're not sure it was, but you know the general category, oh, does she know books? She remembers every book she's ever read, and she can give you suggestions. Nancy Pearl, the second hour of our program. Professor Michael Hagan is here now. We go back to your phone calls and to Frank from Oshkosh next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Hagan.
Hello.
My question is, aside from the horse race, have you ever done any polling on the aspect of electoral or the voter responsibility? For example, those who have voted for Bush, do people feel any sense of responsibility of what has happened in Iraq and the policies that the Bush administration, you know, the consequences of what the Bush administration has done, or, you know, a Democratic administration? Do you have ever done any studies on voter sense of responsibility? For example, the current race, if I would vote, whether it's Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, whatever either one of those administrations would do and the consequences of those administrations, if I will vote for them, I personally would feel responsible, a sense of responsibility of what they do. And then I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That's an interesting question, Frank, and I honestly can't say I've seen polling data on that. So I'm not sure I have too much to say. I mean, I would think that people who voted for Mr. Bush in 2004 and continue to support him would certainly be willing to take responsibility for the state of play right now, but they would regard it as a much more positive set of conditions than would people who voted for President Bush and maybe thinking of voting the other way this time around. But I think it's an interesting question and one I will explore.
Thank you, Frank. Mary from Janesville, hi.
Hi there. How are you today?
Fine, Mary. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much. Professor, this is really not a question. Basically, what I want to do, and I apologize for taking your time for this,
okay.
I would like to rebut what a gentleman said a minute ago or a little bit ago. He called in about talking about McCain's age. I'm 63. I'm a pretty sharp cookie. I'm not real concerned about McCain's age. And I think that he was absolutely right. I think the caller nailed it when he said that it was offensive. Absolutely, it is offensive. But a voter is going to vote the way they vote because of their own position in life, where they are in life, what they've learned, and what they believe that that particular candidate holds for them. And if McCain holds it for those people, then they're going to vote for him. So I guess my point is, age is really kind of irrelevant here. It's about the voter, not about the candidate. They're going to choose who they want to choose, regardless of the polls, regardless of demographics. They're going to choose who they want to choose based on their particular personal history. And that's just really all I have to say.
Thanks, Mary.
One of the interesting features of this campaign, at least in Pennsylvania, is that though we say regardless of demographics, the differences among demographic groups in their intentions with respect to the Democratic primary are enormous. And so that African Americans are overwhelmingly intending to vote for Senator Obama. White women over the age of 40 are overwhelmingly intending to vote for Senator Clinton. Well-educated white
people are intending to vote for Senator Obama. So that it's an odd sort of irony that Senator Obama's campaign is carrying the message that these kinds of differences ought not to matter, that we ought to bridge those differences in order to solve America's problems, and I'm certain that a lot of people agree with that view. At the same time, the differences are in some ways being laid bare by this campaign in which lots of Democrats seem to be trying to figure out which of the two candidates is more like him or her, and choosing on that basis. So I think you're quite right that people choose on the basis of their own position in life and their own personal take on things, but the question of identification with one candidate or the other seems to be critical in this particular campaign.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email, Michael. Have you heard, as we did several weeks ago, about the Clintons getting an enormous amount of money from lobbyists to influence superdelegates? On the other hand, McCain has lots to explain to 56 lobbyists supporting and advising him and the Keating Five involvement. Rosalind from Unity wrote that.
Well, the figures out today on the basis of the most recent reports of the Federal Election Commission are sort of overwhelming in the amount of money that they're talking about having been raised and spent in this mm-hmm. campaign. Senator Obama is now closing in on $200 million. And that money doesn't grow on trees, as my mother used to say. So that money is being raised in places where the money is, and that in many respects is with industries, with businesses that have lots of interest in government.
Let's go to Buck next from Stevens Point. Hi, Buck.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
Professor, as I observed the last 8 years of the Bush presidency, sometimes it appears as though he's governed more as a Democrat might govern. He's been very, very light with the veto pen. Social policies of the conservatives hasn't really been promoted or no progress has been made in that area. Do you think he's governed more as a Democrat, and would it behoove Senator McCain to, in essence, run his campaign based on that he is a true conservative, a true Republican, and that the last 8 years haven't been 8 years of a Republican president? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Sure.
That's a good question. To some degree, Senator McCain has sort of dropped off the radar screen over the past couple of months, and so we've sort of lost sight of the fact that when he sewed up the Republican nomination, the question was, is he going to be able to bring conservatives back into the Republican fold? There was some question about whether Mr. Huckabee would support him, questions being raised by leaders of conservative groups around the country. And that will still remain a question when the fall campaign begins, but certainly Senator McCain now is working hard to repair relations with those groups and to mend his fences with conservatives. It's also true, as you've noted, that Republicans, once they reach the White House, tend not to give as much attention, energy. They tend not to invest as much in social policies as perhaps some folks on the right would like to see them do, and that's been a continued source of frustration for conservatives. And trying to pin Senator McCain down on what exactly he will do is going to be part of what the conservatives bring to the negotiations over the next several months between their groups and Senator McCain.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. We go next to James from Avery. Hi, James.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment on the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. It seems to me that neither three candidates have mentioned a word about it, and I was just like to get some comments on the air about, you know, why he thought that none of these candidates had mentioned it or dared to tread on any ground of it. And you see, with the Security and Prosperity Partnership, President Bush is bringing that full steam ahead, and yet it's somewhat of a stealthy type of a thing as far as no media coverage. Probably 99% of Americans don't know anything about it, and you know, there's somewhat dubious arguments on both sides of, you know, what it means and where it's going and stuff like that. And like I said, regardless of Republican or Democrat for the next president, whether we think that thing will go full steam ahead. And then one other point of connection would be my guess is we're going to have a Democratic president next. Their big issue is universal health care, which will be one step closer to harmonizing us with Canada. And just like to have him speculate a bit about that, but mainly the point of how the candidates have not dared to touch the subject or wanted to touch the subject.
I want to try to catch you before you hang up because I'm in the 99%. You're going to have to help me know what you mean by the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
You've never heard of the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
I haven't either.
What it is and some of the dubious nature of it is it's a working group. You can go online to www.spp.gov and learn about it. Now, that's going to give you the government side, SPP for Security and Prosperity Partnership. You can also Google it in and Yahoo it in, and you can see the other, you know, conspiratorial people's research behind it and see what they say. Now, what it is, it's working groups that are you know, changing different laws and rules and regulations in all these different areas, commerce, energy, security, ports, electricity, all these things. And they have a whole governmental structure that's all kind of a shadow government. And I think the real point of contention for me is we have an elected Congress that's supposed to sit on oversight committees and oversee these different areas, but yet the heads of all three, Canada, America, and Mexico, have appointed groups to start shifting all these and harmonizing them. Of course, the conspiratorial people say it'll be the next North American Union. Of course, they'll need a crisis to implement it, either economic or wartime crisis, something like that. But and like I said, it's pretty stealthy, and none of these coming candidates say anything about it. And that's the biggest thing is, you know, it's President Bush, who's a Republican, is putting on. I'm suspecting when a Democrat gets elected president, that's not going anywhere. That's going to go full steam ahead.
Well, so it sounds like the Security and Prosperity Partnership is in some respects an extension of NAFTA, an attempt to negotiate economic and trade issues among the three countries in North America, although it seems to go well beyond that to security issues as well. But I guess I think that you've answered your own question by saying that 99% of Americans don't know about it. I think the reason that candidates haven't raised the issue is that NAFTA is a much more powerful symbol for them, and if they want to address these kinds of questions about American jobs going elsewhere, about maintaining America's sovereignty, I think NAFTA is a much better target for them.
How is NAFTA playing out in Pennsylvania? Are the candidates spending a lot of time on that issue, Michael?
They are when they're addressing union membership,
yeah, right?
And they touch on it from time to time. It's not a real heavy theme in the television advertising or even in their stump speeches.
Mm-hmm. We want to remind those of you listening that we will be having a special tomorrow night covering the results from Pennsylvania, hosted by Robert Siegel and Melissa Block. So that's at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. You'll get the results in NPR special, and then we'll be doing a lot of this tomorrow or Wednesday as well. Joy Cardine will have analysis at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, and I will at 9 o'clock on Wednesday with Sander Van Oker. Remember Sander Van Oker? And Ben Marin's at 4 o'clock. So you can get your fill of the Pennsylvania primary coming up. Let's go back to phone calls and to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
How are you? I'd like to ask the professor the following. One of these three candidates is going to be president. And with regards to the war, we know what McCain's thinking is. Now, you know, what they say in the campaign trail and what actually happens when they get to the Oval Office are two different things. What are your feelings with regards to how do you think Obama or Clinton are going to handle this situation in Iraq? Because, I mean, it's not so much Iraq. It's our presence in the region, the reality that that's where the oil is, and, you know, how much is that reality going to influence their actions?
I think that's an excellent question. I think I mentioned earlier that some people are concerned that the candidates have painted themselves into corners with respect to some issues, partly owing to the length of the campaign. And I think Iraq is probably exhibit one in that respect. Both candidates have said unequivocally that they will get American troops out. They differ slightly in their timetables for doing it, but both of them are very aggressive timetables for getting American troops out. And
the concern is that both of them are going to feel so committed and be so committed to that particular course of action that they may not be in a position to respond to events as they unfold once one of them were to become president. So I think the question of how much room to maneuver either of these Democratic candidates in particular is going to have should he or she become president is an important one, and one I don't think we can answer right now.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Well, it'll be a big day in Pennsylvania tomorrow, Michael. I hope you have a good time. Will you watch TV all day long, or do you have other stuff to do and you'll catch up tomorrow night?
Little of each, actually. I'll pay attention during the day.
I'm sure.
It's been very exciting. I'm probably more excited about it than most people, and more entertained by it than most people. But I think we're all pleased to be in a position of influencing this outcome. It certainly seemed several months ago like that was impossible. It's been a long time since primary in Pennsylvania was influential, and I think people are excited about it.
Yeah. Well, we loved having you as a guest. Join us again, please, down the road.
Thank you. I'll be
Thank
glad
you.
To.
Professor Michael Hagan, professor of political science at Temple University, director of Temple's Institute for Public Affairs, author of a number of books, and has done some polling himself. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio and then return with our favorite librarian, Nancy Pearl. So please stay tuned as we talk about books on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.